"You shall pay for this." At the moment that she uttered these words, a knock on the ceiling made her raise her head, and a voice which came through the floor called out to her, "Dear Madame Bonancieux, open the little door in the alley, and I will come down to you." 18. The Lover and the Husband. "Ah, madame," said D'Artagnan, as he entered the door which the young woman opened for him, "allow me to tell you that you have but a sorry husband." "What? Have you heard our conversation?" eagerly demanded Madame Bonancieux, looking anxiously at D'Artagnan. "Every word of it." "But, good God, how could you?" "By a plan of my own, whereby I also heard the more animated conversation which you had with the cardinal's myrmidons."
"And what did you understand from what we said?"
"A thousand things. First, that your husband is, happily, a fool and a blockhead. I am heartily glad of this, since it gives me an opportunity of engaging myself in your service, and God knows I am willing to throw myself in the fire for you. Then, that the Queen wants some brave, intelligent, and devoted man to go to London for her. I have, at least, two of the three qualifications which you require, and here I am." Madame Bonancieux did not answer, but her heart beat with joy, and a secret hope sparkled in her eyes.
"And what security will you give me," she demanded, "if I consent to entrust you with this commission?"
"My love for you. Come, speak, command. What is there to be done?"
"My God, my God," uttered the young woman. "Ought I to confide such a secret to you, sir? You are almost a child."
"Oh, I see you want someone who will answer for me."
"I confess that it would give me more confidence."
"Do you know Athos?"
"No."
"Porthos?"
"No."
"Aramis?"
"No.
Who are these gentlemen?" "They belong to the king's musketeers. Do you know Monsieur de Tréville, their captain?"
"Yes, him I do know, not personally, but from having heard him mentioned to the queen as a brave and honourable gentleman."
"You would not fear that he would betray you for the cardinal?"
"Certainly not."
"Well then, reveal to him your secret, and ask him whether, however important, however precious, however terrible it may be, you may not entrust it safely to me."
"But this secret is not mine, and I must not thus disclose it."
"You were going to confide it to Monsieur Bonancieux," said D'Artagnan, with some sharpness.
"As one would confide a letter to a hollow tree, to the wing of a pigeon, or the collar of a dog."
"And yet you know that I love you."
"You say so."
"I am an honourable man."
"I believe it."
"I am brave."
"Oh, of that I am sure."
"Put me to the proof, then."
Madame Bonancieux looked at the young man, restrained only by a last lingering hesitation. But there was so much ardour in his eyes, and so much persuasiveness in his voice, that she felt constrained to trust him. Besides, she was in one of those positions in which it is necessary to run great risks for the sake of great results. The Queen might be as certainly lost by too much caution as by too much confidence. We must confess, also, that the involuntary sentiment which she experienced for this young protector determined her to speak.
"Listen," said she, "I yield to your protestations and assurances, but I swear to you before God, who hears us, that if you betray me and my enemies let me escape, I will destroy myself and accuse you of my death."
"And I swear to you before God, madame," said D'Artagnan, "that if I am seized whilst performing the orders you may give me, I will die sooner than do or say anything to compromise anyone."
Then the young woman confided to him the terrible secret, part of which had been by chance disclosed to him opposite the Samaritan. This was their declaration of mutual love. D'Artagnan glowed with joy and pride. This secret which he possessed, this woman whom he loved, the confidence and the love made him a giant.
"I am off," said he. "I am off directly."
"What, you are going? And what about your regiment, your captain?"
"Upon my life, you made me forget all about them, dear Constance. Yes, you're right. I must get leave of absence."
"Another obstacle," murmured Madame Bonancieux sorrowfully.
"Oh," said D'Artagnan, after a moment's reflection, "I shall easily manage that, never fear."
"How so? I will interview Monsieur de Treville this evening, and will request him to ask this favor for me of his brother-in-law, Monsieur des Essarts.
Now for another thing, said Madame Bonancieux.
And what is that? Inquired D'Artagnan, seeing that she hesitated.
Perhaps you have got no money?
Take away the perhaps, said D'Artagnan, smiling.
Then, said Madame Bonancieux, opening a chest and taking from it the bag which her husband had so lovingly caressed half an hour before, take this bag.
That which belonged to the cardinal? Exclaimed D'Artagnan with a hearty laugh, as, thanks to the uplifted squares, he had not lost one syllable of the conversation between the mercer and his wife.
Yes, the cardinal's, replied Madame Bonancieux. You see that it makes a very imposing appearance.
Egad! Cried D'Artagnan. It will be doubly amusing to save the queen with his eminence's money.
You are an amiable and charming young man, said Madame Bonancieux. And depend upon it, Her Majesty will not prove ungrateful.
Oh, I am abundantly rewarded already, said D'Artagnan. I love you, and you allow me to tell you so. And even this is more happiness than I had dared to hope for.
Hush, said Madame Bonancieux, starting.
What is the matter?
Someone is speaking in the street.
It is the voice
of my husband. Yes, I recognize it.
D'Artagnan ran and bolted the door. He shall not enter till I am gone, said he, and when I have left, you will open the door.
But I ought to be gone too, and the disappearance of this money, how am I to explain it if I am here?
You're right. We must both go.
Go? But how? He will see us if we go out.
Then we must go up to my room.
Ah, exclaimed Madame Bonancieux. You say that in a tone that frightens me.
Madame Bonancieux pronounced these words with tearful eyes. D'Artagnan perceived the tear, and threw himself upon his knees in deep emotion. "On the word of a gentleman," said he, "in my room you shall be as sacred as in a temple."
"Let us go, then, my friend," said she. "I trust in that word."
D'Artagnan carefully unfastened the bolt, and both, light as shadows, glided through the inner door into the court, and, noiselessly ascending the stairs, entered D'Artagnan's chamber. Once in his own room, the young man, for greater security, barricaded the door, and then they both went to the window, and, through a chink of the shutter, saw Monsieur Bonancieux talking to a man in a cloak. At the sight of the man in the cloak, D'Artagnan made a spring, and, partly drawing his sword, rushed towards the door. It was the man of Meung.
"What are you going to do?"
cried Madame Bonancieux.
"You will ruin us all!
But I have sworn to kill that man!" said D'Artagnan.
"Your life is at present consecrated, and does not belong to you. In the Queen's name, I forbid you to throw yourself into any danger beyond that of the journey."
"And in your own name do you command nothing?"
"Yes, in my own name," said Madame Bonancieux with emotion. "In my own name I entreat you. But listen, I think they are talking about me."
D'Artagnan approached the window and listened. Monsieur Bonancieux had opened his door, and finding the room empty, had returned to the man in the cloak, whom he had left for an instant alone.
"She is gone," said he. "She must have returned to the Louvre."
"You are quite sure," replied the stranger, "that she had no suspicion of your object in going out?"
"No,"
said Bonancieux with much self-complacence.
"She is a woman of too superficial an intellect."
"And the young guardsman? Is he at home?"
"I do not think he is. As you may perceive, his shutter is closed, and there is no light in his room."
"Never mind. We had better make certain."
"How so?"
"By rapping at his door."
"I will ask his servant."
"Go."
Bonancieux re-entered his room, passed through the same door which had just given egress to the two fugitives, ascended to D'Artagnan's landing place, and knocked. No one answered. Porthos, in order to make a display, had borrowed Planchet for that evening, and as for D'Artagnan, he was careful to give no sign of his presence. At the moment that Bonancieux's knock resounded on the door, the young people felt their hearts bound.
"There is no one at home," said Bonancieux.
"Let us go into your room, nevertheless. We shall be in greater privacy than at the door."
"Oh, my God!" said Madame Bonancieux. "We shall not hear any more."
"On the contrary," said D'Artagnan,
We shall hear all the better.
D'Artagnan lifted up the 3 or 4 squares which made another Saint Denis's ear of his chamber, laid a piece of carpet on the floor, kneeled down upon it, and then made a sign to Madame Bonancieux to lean, as he was doing, over the aperture.
"You are sure that there is no one?" said the stranger.
"Quite," said Bonancieux.
"And you think that your wife
is returned to the Louvre?"
"Without speaking to any other person than yourself?"
"I'm sure of it."
"It is a point of the greatest importance, do you understand?"
"Then the intelligence I have given you is of some value?"
"Very great, my dear Bonancieux. I would not disguise it to you."
"Then the cardinal will be satisfied with me."
"I do not doubt it."
"The great cardinal!"
"You are quite sure that in her conversation with you your wife mentioned no names?"
"I am almost sure."
"She did not mention either Madame de Chevreuse or the Duke of Buckingham or Madame de Vernel?"
"No. She merely said that she wished to send me to London in the service of an illustrious person." "The traitor!"
muttered Madame Bonancieux.
"Hush!" said D'Artagnan, taking her hand, which she gave up to him without a thought.
"Never mind," said the man in the cloak. "You're a blockhead for not pretending to accept the commission. Then you would have had the letter in your possession. The state, which is in danger, would have been saved, and you..."
"And I?"
"Well, and you, the cardinal would have given you letters of nobility."
"Did he tell you so?"
"Yes. I know that he wished to surprise you with this present."
"Be easy," replied Bonancieux. "My wife adores me, and there is plenty of time yet."
"The ninny!"
whispered Madame Bonancieux.
"Be quiet," said D'Artagnan, pressing her hand more closely.
"What, is there yet time?" said the man in the cloak.
"I shall proceed to the Louvre, ask for Madame Bonancieux, say that I have considered the affair, obtain the letter, and hasten to the cardinal."
"Well, go quickly. I will soon return to know the result of your proceedings."
The stranger then departed.
"The wretch!"
said Madame Bonancieux, referring to her husband.
"Silence!"
said D'Artagnan, again pressing her hand, and this time yet more warmly. A terrible hullabaloo interrupted the reflections of D'Artagnan and Madame Bonancieux. It was her husband who had just discovered the loss of his bag, and was exclaiming against the robber.
"Oh, my God!" exclaimed Madame Bonancieux. "He will awaken all the neighborhood!"
Bonancieux cried out for a long time. But as such cries were of common occurrence, they attracted no attention in the Rue des Fossoyeurs. And as the mercer's house was, moreover, in no very good repute, finding that nobody came to his help, he went out, still uttering his outcries, which they heard gradually dying away in the direction of the Rue du Bac.
"And now that he is gone, it is your turn to depart," said Madame Bonancieux. "Be brave, but above all, be prudent, and remember that you serve the Queen."
"The Queen and you," exclaimed D'Artagnan. "Be assured, beautiful Constance, that I shall return worthy of her gratitude. But shall I return worthy also of your love?"
The young woman only replied by the glowing blush that mantled on her cheek. After a few moments, D'Artagnan went out in his turn, enveloped in a long cloak, which was cavalierly thrust backward by the sheath of his enormous sword. Madame Bonancieux followed him with that long look of affection which woman fixes on the man she loves. But as soon as he had turned the corner of the street, she sank upon her knees, and joining her hands, exclaimed,
"Oh, my God, preserve the Queen, and preserve me!"
19. The Plan of Campaign. D'Artagnan went straight to Monsieur de Tréville. He had reflected that the cardinal would, in a few minutes, be put upon his guard by that cursed stranger, who appeared to be his agent, and he very wisely thought that there was not a moment to lose.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please insert disc number 7. This is disc number 7.
19. The Plan of Campaign. D'Artagnan went straight to Monsieur de Tréville. He had reflected that the cardinal would, in a few minutes, be put upon his guard by that cursed stranger, who appeared to be his agent, and he very wisely thought that there was not a moment to lose. The heart of the young man overflowed with joy. An adventure was presented to him by which both gold and glory might be won, and which, as a first encouragement, brought him into communication with the woman he adored. This chance had thus given to him at once more than he had even dared to solicit from Providence. Monsieur de Tréville was in his saloon, surrounded by his usual circle of gentlemen. D'Artagnan, who was known as an intimate of the house, went directly to his cabinet and asked to speak to him on business of importance. He had scarcely been there 5 minutes before Monsieur de Tréville entered. At the first glance, and from the joy which sparkled in D'Artagnan's eyes, the worthy captain at once perceived that some new scheme was really in his mind. On his way there, D'Artagnan had been considering whether he should confide in Monsieur de Tréville, or merely ask for a free leave of absence for a secret expedition. But Monsieur de Tréville had always been so kind to him, was so entirely devoted to the king and queen, and so cordially hated the cardinal, that the young man determined to tell him all the affair.
"You send for me, my young friend?" said Monsieur de Tréville.
"Yes, sir," said D'Artagnan, "and you will pardon me, I hope, for having disturbed you when you know the importance of the occasion."
"Speak, then. I am all attention."
"It is nothing less," said D'Artagnan, speaking low, "than that the honor, and perhaps the life, of the queen is at stake."
"What are you saying?"
said Monsieur de Tréville, looking round, to be certain that they were alone.
"I say, sir, that chance has made me master of a secret." "Which you will guard with your life, I hope, young man."
"But which I ought to impart to you, sir, for you alone can assist me in the mission which has just been entrusted on behalf of Her Majesty."
"Is this secret your own?"
"No, sir, it is the Queen's."
"Are you authorized by the Queen to impart it to me?"
"No, sir, for on the contrary, the most profound secrecy is recommended."
"And why, then, are you about to betray it to me?"
"Because, as I tell you, without you I am powerless, and I fear that you will refuse me the favor which I come to solicit, unless you know the purpose for which it is solicited."
"Keep your secret, young man, and tell me what you want."
"I wish you to obtain for me, from Monsieur des Essarts, a leave of absence for 15 days.
"When?"
"This very night."
"Do you leave Paris?"
"I go on a mission."
"Can you tell me where?"
"To London."
"Has anyone an interest in preventing the success of your design?"
"The cardinal, I believe, would give all the world to prevent that success."
"And do you go alone?"
"Yes."
"In that case, you will not get past Bondy. It is I who tell you so, on the word of Tréville."
"And why so?"
"You will be assassinated."
"I shall be doing my duty."
"But your mission will not be performed."
"That is true," said D'Artagnan.
"Believe me," said Monsieur de Tréville, "in every enterprise of this kind, there ought to be 4 at least, in order that one may succeed."
"Ah, sir, you are right," said D'Artagnan. "But you know Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, and you can judge whether I may employ them."
"Without imparting to them the secret, which I should rather not know?"
"We have sworn to one another once for all a blind confidence and a devotion proof against all trials. Besides, you can tell them that you have the fullest confidence in me, and they will not be more incredulous than yourself."
"I can give each of them a leave of absence for 15 days, and that is all. To Athos, who still suffers from his wound, to go to the waters of Forges. And to Porthos and Aramis, to follow their friend, whom they do not wish to abandon in his melancholy condition. My sending their leave will be a proof that I authorize the expedition."
"Thank you. 1,000 thanks, sir, for your goodness."
"Go and find them, then, immediately, and let everything be settled this very night. But first, write me your request to Monsieur des Essarts. Perhaps you had a spy at your heels, and your visit, which is in that case already known to the cardinal, will be thus accounted for."
D'Artagnan wrote his request in due form, and Monsieur de Tréville, as he received it from him, assured him that before 2 in the morning the 4 furloughs should be at the respective homes of the travellers. "Have the goodness to send mine to the lodgings of Athos," said D'Artagnan. "I should be afraid of some disagreeable encounter if I returned home again."
"Don't be uneasy. Farewell, and a good journey to you," said Monsieur de Tréville. "But," he added, recalling him, "apropos..."
D'Artagnan returned.
"Have you got any money?"
D'Artagnan replied by shaking the bag which he had in his pocket.
"Have you enough?"
said Monsieur de Tréville.
300 pistoles. "That will do. You might go to the end of the world with that."
D'Artagnan bowed to Monsieur de Tréville, and pressed the hand which he offered him with respect, mingled with gratitude. From the time of his arrival in Paris, this excellent man had been uniformly entitled to his highest esteem. He had found him always consistent, honorable, and elevated. His first visit was to Aramis. He had not been to his friend's lodging since the evening when he had followed Madame Bonancieux, and, what is more, he had scarcely seen him since. But whenever he had met him, he fancied that he saw a corroding sorrow stamped upon his countenance. This evening, also, Aramis was sorrowful and dreamy. D'Artagnan put some questions to him concerning this continued melancholy, but Aramis ascribed it to a commentary on the 18th chapter of St. Augustine, which he was obliged to write in Latin by the following week, and which much occupied him. When the two friends had been talking some time, a servant of Monsieur de Tréville brought a sealed packet.
"What is that?" demanded Aramis.
"The leave of absence which Monsieur has demanded," replied the servant.
"Me? I have not demanded a leave."
"Hold your tongue and take it," said D'Artagnan. "And here, my friend, here is a half-pistole for your trouble. You will tell Monsieur de Tréville that Monsieur Aramis very sincerely thanks him. Go."
The servant bowed to the ground and left the room.
"What does all this mean?"
inquired Aramis.
"Pack what you may want for a 15 days' journey and follow me."
"But I cannot leave Paris at present without knowing..."
Aramis stopped himself.
"What is become of her? Is that not it?" continued D'Artagnan.
"Whom?"
resumed Aramis.
"The lady who was here, the lady with the embroidered handkerchief."
"Who told you there was a lady here?"
said Aramis, becoming as pale as death.
"I saw her."
"And do you know who she is?"
"I think I have a fair idea, at least."
"Listen," said Aramis. "Since you know so many things, do you know what has become of this lady?"
"I presume that she has returned to Tours."
"To Tours?" "Yes, that may be. You evidently know her. But how is it that she returned to Tours without saying anything to me about it?"
"Because she was in fear of being arrested."
"Why did she not write to me?"
"Because she was afraid of compromising you."
"D'Artagnan, you give me new life," cried Aramis. "I believed that I was despised, deceived. I was so happy to see her again. I could not believe that she had hazarded her liberty to see me. And yet, for what other cause could she have returned to Paris?"
"For the same cause which this day obliges us to go to England."
"And what is that cause?" demanded Aramis.
"You shall know it some day, Aramis. But for the present, I will imitate the discretion of the doctor's niece."
Aramis smiled, for he remembered the tale he had told his friends on a certain evening.
"Well, then, since she has left Paris, and you are sure of it, D'Artagnan, nothing more detains me here, and I am ready to follow you. You say we are going
to Athos at present, and if you wish to come, I beg you will make haste, for we have already lost too much time. Apropos, tell Bazin."
"Does Bazin accompany us?" inquired Aramis.
"Perhaps so. At any rate, it is better that he should follow us to Athos."
Aramis called Bazin, and after having told him to come to them at Athos's,
"Let us go then,"
said he, taking his cloak, his sword, his pistols, and fruitlessly opening 3 or 4 drawers in hopes of finding a few stray pistols. Then, when he was quite satisfied that this search was useless, he followed D'Artagnan, wondering how it was that the young guardsman knew, as well as he did, who the lady was to whom he had afforded hospitality, and knew better than he did where she was now gone. Just as they were going out, he laid his hand on D'Artagnan's arm and looked earnestly at him.
"You have not spoken to anyone about this lady?" said he.
"To no one in the world.
Not even to Porthos and Athos?"
"I have not breathed a word to them about it."
"That's right."
Satisfied on that important point, Aramis went on his way with D'Artagnan, and they both soon reached Athos's lodgings. They found him holding his leave absence in one hand and Monsieur de Tréville's letter in the other. "Can you explain to me," said he, "what these mean that I have just received?" "My dear Athos, I very much wish, as your health absolutely requires it, that you should repose yourself for 15 days. Go, therefore, and take the waters of Forges, or any others which may better agree with you, and get well quickly. Yours affectionately, Tréville."
"Well," said D'Artagnan, "the leave and the letter mean that you must follow me."
"To the waters of Forges?"
"There or elsewhere."
"On the king's service?"
"The king's or the queen's.
Are we not servants of both?"
At this moment Porthos entered.
"Egad," said he, "here's a curious circumstance. Since when have they granted leave to the musketeers without their asking for it?"
"Ever since they have had friends who ask it for them," said D'Artagnan.
"Ah, aha," said Porthos. "It appears that there is something fresh in the wind."
"Yes, we are off," said Aramis.
"To what country?"
demanded Porthos.
"Upon my word, I do not know exactly," said Athos.
"Ask D'Artagnan."
"To London, gentlemen," said D'Artagnan.
"To London," said Porthos. "And what are you going to do there?"
"And that is what I cannot tell you, gentlemen. You must trust to me."
"But to go to London, money is necessary, and I have none," said Porthos.
"Nor I," said Aramis.
"Nor I," said Athos.
"I have," said D'Artagnan, lugging his treasure out of his pocket and laying it on the table.
"There are in that bag 300 pistoles. Let each of us take 75, which is quite enough to go to London and to return. Besides, be easy. We shall not all reach London."
"And why not?"
"Because, according to all probability, some of us will be left on the road."
"Is it a campaign, then, that we are about to undertake?"
"Yes, and a most dangerous one, I forewarn you."
"Ah, but since we risk our lives, I at least would rather know the object," said Porthos.
"That will do you a mighty deal of good," replied Athos.
"Nevertheless," said Aramis, "I am of the same opinion as Porthos."
"Pray," said D'Artagnan, "does the king usually give you his reasons?"
"He tells you bluntly, 'Gentlemen, they are fighting in Gascony or in Flanders. Go and fight.' And you go. As for any reasons, you do not trouble your heads about them."
"D'Artagnan is right," said Athos. "Behold our 3 leaves of absence, which come from Monsieur de Tréville. And here are 300 pistoles, which come from I know not where. Let us go and be killed where we are told to go. Is life worth so many questions? D'Artagnan, I am ready to follow you."
"And I also," said Porthos.
"And I also," said Aramis. "I shall not be sorry to leave Paris after all. I need distractions."
"Well, you will have quite enough of them, gentlemen, depend upon it," said D'Artagnan. "And now, when must we set off?" inquired Athos.
"Directly," said D'Artagnan. "Not a minute must be lost."
"Hollo, Grimaud, Planchet, Mousqueton, Bazin," bawled out the 4 young men, calling their servants. "Polish our boots and fetch our horses from the hotel."
In fact, each musketeer left at the general hotel, as at a barrack, his own horse and that of his servant. Planchet, Mousqueton, Grimaud, and Bazin departed in the utmost haste.
"Now, let us arrange the plan of the campaign," said Porthos. "Where are we to go first?"
"To Calais," said D'Artagnan. "It is the most direct line to London."
"Well," said Porthos, "my advice is as follows."
"Speak, what is it?"
Four men traveling together will be suspected. D'Artagnan must therefore give his instructions to each of us. I will go first by way of Boulogne to clear the road. Athos shall set out 2 hours after by that of Amiens. Aramis will follow us by that of Noyon. And as for D'Artagnan, he will travel by that which he likes best, in Planchet's clothes, whilst Planchet himself shall follow, in the uniform of the guards, to pass for D'Artagnan.
Gentlemen, said Athos, my advice is not to include the servants in anything of this kind. A secret may perchance be betrayed by gentlemen, but is almost always sold by servants.
The plan of Porthos appears to me to be impracticable, said D'Artagnan, as I do not myself know what instructions I could give you. I am the bearer of a letter, that is all. I have not, and I cannot make 3 copies of this letter, since it is sealed. We must, therefore, in my opinion, travel in company. The letter is here, in this pocket. And he pointed out the pocket which contained the letter. If I am killed, one of you will take it, and will continue the journey. If he is killed, it will be another's turn, and so on. Provided only one should arrive, it is all that is necessary.
Bravo, D'Artagnan. Your advice is also mine, said Athos. Nevertheless, we must be consistent. I'm going to take the waters, and you will accompany me. But instead of going to Forges, I'm going to the seaside. I may take my choice. If anybody wants to arrest us, I show Monsieur de Treville's letter, and you will show your leaves of absence. If they attack us, we will defend ourselves. If they interrogate us, we must maintain sharply that we had no other intention than to dip ourselves a certain number of times in the sea. They would have too easy a conquest over 4 separate men, whilst 4 men united make a troop. We will arm our 4 servants with musketoons and pistols, and if they send an army against us, we will give battle, and the survivor, as D'Artagnan has said, will deliver the letter.
Well done, said Aramis. You do not speak often, Athos, but when you do speak, it is like St. John with the golden mouth. I adopt the plan of Athos.
And you, Porthos?
And I also, said Porthos, if it suits D'Artagnan. As the bearer of the letter, he is naturally the leader of the enterprise. Let him decide, and we will execute.
Well then, said D'Artagnan, I decide that we adopt the plan of Athos, and that we set out in 30 minutes.
Agreed, exclaimed the 3 musketeers in chorus.
And each, plunging his hand into the bag, took from it 75 pistoles, and made his preparations to depart at the appointed time.
20. The Journey. At 2 o'clock in the morning, our 4 adventurers left Paris by the Porte Saint-Denis. Whilst the darkness lasted, they continued silent. In spite of themselves, they felt the influence of the obscurity, and suspected an ambuscade at every step. With the first streak of day, their tongues became unbound, and gaiety returned with the sun. It was as on the eve of battle. The heart beat and the eyes sparkled, and they felt that the life which they were perhaps about to leave was, after all, a pleasant and a precious thing. The appearance of the cavalcade was of the most formidable character. The black horses of the musketeers, their martial bearing, and that military custom which made these noble chargers march in rank, were all indications of their calling, which would have betrayed the strictest incognito. The valets followed, armed to the teeth. All went on well as far as Chantilly, where they arrived at about 8 in the morning, and where they were obliged to breakfast. They dismounted at a tavern which was recommended by the sign of St. Martin, giving 1/2 his cloak to a beggar. They ordered their servants not to unsaddle their horses, and to be ready to depart at a moment's notice. They entered the common room of the inn, and placed themselves at table. A gentleman who had arrived by the Dampmartin road was seated at the table, breakfasting. He entered into conversation concerning the rain and the fine weather. The travellers replied. He drank to their healths, and they returned his politeness. But at the moment when Mousqueton came to announce that the horses were ready, and as they arose from table, the stranger proposed to Porthos to drink the cardinal's health. Porthos replied that he desired nothing better,
provided the stranger would, in turn, drink the health of the king. The stranger exclaimed that he knew no other king than His Eminence. On this, Porthos told him he must be drunk, and the stranger drew his sword. "You have done a foolish thing," said Athos. "But never mind, you cannot draw back now. Kill the fellow and come after us as fast as you can." And all three mounted their horses and departed at full speed, whilst Porthos promised his adversary to perforate him in all the fashions known to the fencing school. "There goes one of us," said Athos, after they had travelled 500 paces.
"But why did that man attack Porthos rather than the others?" said Aramis.
"Because, from Porthos speaking louder than the rest of us, he took him for the leader of the party," said D'Artagnan. "I always said," muttered Athos, "that the Gascon youth was a well of wisdom." The travellers proceeded on their way. At Beauvais they stopped 2 hours, as much to breathe their horses as to wait for Porthos. At the end of that time, as neither Porthos nor any intelligence of him had arrived, they resumed their journey. About a league from Beauvais, at a point where the way was narrowed between 2 banks, they met 8 or 10 men, who, taking advantage of the road being unpaved at this place, seemed to be engaged in digging holes and making muddy ruts. Aramis, fearing to dirty his boots in this artificial slough, apostrophized them rudely. Athos wished to restrain him, but it was too late. The workmen began to rail at the travellers, and by their insolence even ruffled the temper of the cool Athos, who urged his horse against one of them. At this aggression, each of these men drew back to the ditch, and took from it a musket that was concealed there. The result was that our 7 travellers were literally riddled by shot. Aramis received a ball through the shoulder, and Mousqueton another in the fleshy part of the back, below the loins. But Mousqueton alone fell from his horse. Not that he was seriously wounded, but that he could not see his wound, he no doubt thought it far more dangerous than it really was. "This is an ambuscade," said D'Artagnan. "Let us not burn priming, but away." Aramis, wounded as he was, seized the mane of his horse, which carried him off with the others. That of Mousqueton had rejoined them and galloped riderless by their side. "That will give us a spare horse," said Athos. "I should much prefer a hat," said D'Artagnan, "for mine has been carried off by a ball. It is very lucky, faith, that my letter was not within it."
"Ah, but they will kill poor Porthos when he comes up," said Aramis.
"If Porthos were upon his legs, he would have rejoined us ere this," said Athos. "It is my opinion that in the combat the drunkard grew sober." They galloped on for 2 more hours, although the horses were so fatigued that it was to be feared they would break down on the way. The travellers had made a detour by crossroads, hoping thereby to be less molested. But at Crèvecœur, Aramis declared that he could go no farther. In fact, it had required all the courage which he concealed beneath his elegant form and polished manners to proceed so far. At each movement he grew paler, and they were at last obliged to support him on his horse. Putting him down at the door of a wine shop, and leaving him with Bazin, who was more hindrance than help in a skirmish, they set off again, in hopes of reaching Amiens, and passing the night there. "Zounds!" said Athos, when they found themselves once more upon the way, reduced to 2 masters, with Grimaud and Planchet. "Zounds! I will be their dupe no more! I promise you that they shall not make me open my mouth or draw my sword between here and Calais. I swear—" "Don't swear," said D'Artagnan, "but gallop. That is, if our horses will consent to it." And the travellers dug their spurs into the flanks of their horses, which, thus urged, recovered some degree of strength. They reached Amiens at midnight, and dismounted at the sign of the Golden Lily. The innkeeper had the look of the most honest fellow upon earth. He received the travellers with a candlestick in one hand and his cotton nightcap in the other. He wished to lodge the 2 travellers, each in a charming chamber, but unfortunately these 2 chambers were at opposite extremities of the hotel. D'Artagnan and Athos declined them. The host objected that he had no others worthy of their excellences. But they declared that they would rather sleep in the common room on mattresses upon the floor. The host insisted, but the travellers were obstinate and carried their point. They had just arranged their beds and barricaded the door when someone knocked at the shutters.
They inquired who was there, and on recognizing the voices of their servants, opened the window. It was indeed Planchet and Grimaud.
"Grimaud will be quite able to guard the horses," said Planchet, "and if the gentlemen like, I will sleep across their door, by which means they will be certain that no one can get at them."
"And on what will you sleep?" asked D'Artagnan.
"This is my bed,"
replied Planchet, strewing a bundle of straw. "Come, then," said D'Artagnan. "You are quite right. The countenance of our host does not at all please me. It is far too polite."
"Nor me, either," said Athos.
Planchet got in at the window and laid himself across the doorway, whilst Grimaud shut himself up in the stable, promising that at 5 in the morning he and the 4 horses should be ready. The night passed quickly enough. Someone attempted, about 2 o'clock, to open the door, but as Planchet awoke with a start and cried out, "Who is there?" he was answered that it was a mistake, and then the footsteps retreated. At 4 in the morning, a great noise was heard from the stables. Grimaud had endeavoured to awake the ostlers, and they had made an attack upon him. When the window was opened, they saw the poor fellow lying senseless with his head split open by a blow from a broom handle. Planchet went into the courtyard and wanted to saddle the horses, but the horses were completely foundered. That of Grimaud, which had travelled for 5 or 6 hours with an empty saddle the evening before, might have continued its journey. But by an inconceivable mistake, the veterinary surgeon, whom they had brought, as it appeared, to bleed the landlord's horse, had bled that of Grimaud instead. This began to be vexatious. All these successive accidents were perhaps the result of chance, but they might also be the effect of design. Athos and D'Artagnan stepped out, whilst Planchet went to inquire whether there were 3 horses to be sold in the neighbourhood. At the door were 2 horses ready saddled, fresh and vigorous. This was just the thing. He asked where their masters were, and was informed that they had passed the night there, and were now paying their bill. Athos went down to settle their account, whilst D'Artagnan and Planchet remained at the door. The innkeeper was in a distant lower room, which Athos was requested to enter. Athos went in confidently, and took out 2 pistoles to pay. The host was alone and seated at his desk, one of the drawers of which was partly open. He took the money which Athos gave him, turned it over in his hands, and suddenly exclaiming that the pieces were bad, declared that he would have him and his companion arrested as passers of false coin.
"You rascal," said Athos as he went towards him, "I will cut off your ears."
But the host stooped down, and taking 2 pistols from the drawer, presented them at Athos, vociferating at the same time for help. At that very moment, 4 men, armed to the teeth, rushed in through the side doors and fell upon Athos.
"I am seized!" bawled Athos with the utmost strength of his lungs. "Away with you, D'Artagnan! Spur on! Spur on!"
And he fired off his 2 pistols. D'Artagnan and Planchet did not wait to be twice warned. They unfastened the 2 horses which were standing at the door, jumped upon them, dug the spurs into their flanks, and went off at full gallop.
"Do you know what has become of Athos?" asked D'Artagnan, as they hurried on.
"Oh, sir!" said Planchet. "I saw 2 men fall at his shots, and it seemed to me, through the window, as if he were working away at the others with his sword."
"Brave Athos!" ejaculated D'Artagnan. "And then to know that I must abandon you! Well, the same thing awaits us, perhaps, at 10 paces hence. Forward, Planchet, forward! You are a brave fellow!"
"I told you, sir," replied Planchet. "The Picards are only known by being used. Besides, I am in my own country here, and that stimulates me."
And both of them, spurring on as fast as possible, arrived at Saint-Omer without a moment's stay. At Saint-Omer they breathed their horses, with their bridles looped on their arms for fear of accident, and ate a morsel standing in the street, after which they again set off. At 100 paces from the gate of Calais, D'Artagnan's horse fell, and could by no means be got up again. The blood gushed from his eyes and nose. That of Planchet still remained, but he had chosen to halt, and nothing could induce him to continue his exertions. Fortunately, as we have said, they were only 100 paces from the town. They therefore left the 2 steeds upon the high road and ran to the harbour. Planchet made his master remark a gentleman who had just arrived with his lackey,
and was not above 50 yards before them. They hastily drew near this gentleman, who appeared to be exceedingly busy. His boots were covered with dust, and he inquired whether he could not pass over to England instantaneously.
"Nothing easier," replied the master of a vessel then ready for sailing. "But an order arrived this morning to let no one leave without permission from the Cardinal."
"I have got that permission," said the gentleman, drawing a paper from his pocket. "There it is."
"Get it countersigned by the governor of the port," said the master of the vessel, "and give me the preference."
"Where shall I find the governor?"
"At his country house."
"And where is his country house situated?"
"At a quarter of a league from the town. See, you may distinguish it from here. Yonder slated roof at the foot of the little hill."
"Very well," said the gentleman, and followed by his servant, he took the road to the governor's country house. D'Artagnan and Planchet followed him at the distance of 500 yards. Once out of the town, D'Artagnan hurried forwards and made up on the gentleman as he entered a small wood.
"Sir," said D'Artagnan, "you appear in particular haste."
"No one can be more so, sir."
"I am very sorry for it," said D'Artagnan, "for, as I am in a hurry also, I want you to render me a favour."
"What is it?"
"To let me pass the straits before you."
"Impossible," said the gentleman. "I have done 60 leagues in 44 hours, and I must be in London by noon tomorrow."
"And I," said D'Artagnan, "have gone the same distance in 40 hours, and must be in London by 10 o'clock tomorrow."
"Sorry to disappoint you, sir, but I have got here first, and I will not go over second."
"I am grieved also, sir," said D'Artagnan, "but I have got here second, and mean to go over first."
"The king's service," said the gentleman.
"My own service," replied D'Artagnan.
"But it seems to me that this is a poor quarrel which you are seeking to make."
"Zounds, what would you have it?"
"What do you want?"
"Do you want to know?"
"Certainly."
"Very well. I want the order that you have in your pocket, as I have none, and must have one."
"I presume you are joking."
"I never joke."
"Let me pass, sir."
"You shall not pass."
"My gallant, I will blow your brains out."
"Hullo, Lubin, my pistols!" "Planchet," said D'Artagnan, "take care of the man. I will manage the master."
Planchet, encouraged by what had already happened, rushed upon Lubin, and as he was strong and vigorous, laid him on his back and put his knee upon his breast.
"Do your business, sir," said Planchet to his master. "I have settled mine."
Seeing this, the gentleman drew his sword and fell on D'Artagnan. But he had to do with rather a tough customer. In 3 seconds, D'Artagnan gave him 3 wounds, saying at each thrust,
"One for Athos, one for Porthos, and one for Aramis."
At the 3rd stroke, the gentleman fell like a log. D'Artagnan thought he was dead, or at least that he had fainted, and approached him to seize the order. But at the moment that he stretched out his hand to search for it, the wounded man, who had not dropped his sword, stabbed him with it on the chest, saying,
"One for you, and one more for you, and the best last," cried D'Artagnan, furiously pinning him to the earth with a 4th wound through the body.
This time the gentleman closed his eyes and fainted. D'Artagnan felt in the pocket where he had seen him place the order for his passage, and took it. It was in the name of the Count de Wardes. Then, throwing a last glance on the handsome young man, who was scarcely 25 years old, and whom he left lying there senseless, and perhaps dead, he breathed a sigh at the strange destiny which leads men to destroy each other for the interests of those they scarcely know, and who often are not even aware of their existence. But he was soon disturbed in these reflections by Lubin, who was howling with all his might and crying for aid. Planchet put his hand upon his throat and squeezed it as hard as he could.
"Sir," said he, "as long as I hold him so, he will not cry out, but the moment I leave go, he will begin again. I can see he is a Norman, and the Normans are monstrously obstinate."
In fact, squeezed as he was, Lubin still endeavoured to sound his pipes.
"Stop,"
said D'Artagnan, and taking his handkerchief, he gagged him.
"Now," said Planchet, "let us bind him to a tree."
The thing was properly done. They then placed the Count de Wardes near his servant, and as the night began to fall, and as both the bound man and the wounded one were some paces in the wood, it was clear that they must remain there till the next morning.
"And now,"
said D'Artagnan, "to the house of the governor."
"You are wounded, I fear," said Planchet.
"It is nothing. Let us now think of what is of the most consequence. We can attend to my wound afterwards. Besides, it does not appear to be very dangerous." And they both proceeded with prodigious strides towards the country house of the worthy functionary. The Count de Wardes was announced. D'Artagnan was introduced.
"Have you an order signed by the cardinal?" asked the governor.
"Yes, sir," said D'Artagnan. "Here it is."
It is regular and explicit," said the governor.
"That is quite natural," answered D'Artagnan. "I am one of his most faithful servants."
"It appears that His Eminence wishes to hinder someone from reaching England."
"Yes, a certain D'Artagnan, a Bernese gentleman, who left Paris with three of his friends, intending to go to London."
"Do you know him personally?"
inquired the governor.
"Whom?" "This D'Artagnan."
"Perfectly well."
"Give me some description of him, then."
"Nothing is easier." And then D'Artagnan gave, feature for feature, the exact description of the Count de Wardes.
"Has he any attendant?"
demanded the governor. "Yes, a servant named Lubin."
"We will watch for them, and if we can lay hands upon them, His Eminence may be assured that they shall be sent back to Paris under a sufficient escort."
"In so doing, sir," said D'Artagnan, "you will merit the gratitude of the cardinal."
"Will you see him on your return, Count?"
"Without doubt."
"Tell him, I beseech you," said the governor, "that I am his most humble servant."
"I will not fail to do so." Delighted by this assurance, the governor countersigned the order and returned it to D'Artagnan, who lost no time in useless compliments, but having bowed to him and thanked him, took his leave. Once out of the house, they took a circuitous path to avoid the wood and entered the town by another gate. The bark was still ready to sail, and the master waited on the quay.
"Well,"
said he, seeing D'Artagnan, "here is my pass, countersigned."
"And the other gentleman?"
"He is not going over today," said D'Artagnan. "But make yourself easy. I will pay for the passage of both."
"In that case, let us be off,"
said the master.
"Away then," cried D'Artagnan. And he and Planchet, springing into the boat, in 5 minutes they were on board the vessel. It was full time, for when they were half a league out at sea, D'Artagnan saw a flash and heard a detonation. It was the sound of the cannon that announced the closing of the port. It was now time to think about his wound. Happily, it was, as D'Artagnan had supposed, not at all dangerous. The point of the sword had struck against the rib and glanced along the bone, and as the shirt had stuck to the wound at once, scarcely a drop of blood had flowed. D'Artagnan was overpowered with fatigue, and a mattress being spread for him on the deck, he threw himself upon it and slept. The next morning, at break of day, he found himself at not less than 3 or 4 leagues from the shores of England. The wind had been gentle during the night, and they had made but little progress. At 2 o'clock they cast anchor in the harbour of Dover, and at 2:30 D'Artagnan landed in England, exclaiming, "Here I am at last!" But this was not enough. He must get to London. In England, posting was pretty well regulated. D'Artagnan and Planchet took each a post-horse. A postillion galloped before them, and in a few hours they reached the gates of London. The Duke was hunting at Windsor with the King. D'Artagnan knew nothing of London. He knew not one word of English, but he wrote the word Buckingham on a piece of paper, and everyone could direct him to the mansion of the Duke. D'Artagnan inquired for the Duke's confidential valet, who, having accompanied him in all his journeys, spoke French perfectly. He told him that he came from Paris on an affair of life and death, and that he must speak with his master without an instant's delay. The confidence with which D'Artagnan spoke satisfied Patrick, for that was the name of the minister's minister. He ordered 2 horses to be saddled, and took upon himself the charge of guiding the young guardsman. As for poor Planchet, they had taken him off his horse as stiff as a stake. The poor fellow was quite exhausted, but D'Artagnan seemed to be made of iron. They reached Windsor Castle, where they learned that the King and the Duke were out hawking in some marshes 2 or 3 miles off. In 20 minutes they reached the place. Patrick heard his master's voice calling his hawk.
"Whom shall I announce to my lord?"
said Patrick.
"The young man," said D'Artagnan, "who sought a quarrel with him one evening on the Pont Neuf, opposite the Samaritan."
"A strange recommendation," said Patrick.
"You will see that it is as good as anyone could be." Patrick gave his horse the rein, reached the Duke, and told him, in the very words which we have just used, that a messenger awaited him. Buckingham at once remembered D'Artagnan, and fearing that something had happened in France, of which information had been sent to him, he only gave himself time to ask where the messenger was, and having recognized the uniform of the guards at that distance, he rode at full speed straight up to D'Artagnan. Patrick judiciously kept himself in the background.
"No misfortune has befallen the Queen," cried Buckingham.
"I think not, sir, but I believe that she is in great danger, from which your Grace alone can rescue her."
"I," said Buckingham, "and how shall I be sufficiently happy to render her any service? Speak, speak!"
"Take this letter," said D'Artagnan.
"This letter? And from whom comes this letter?"
"From Her Majesty, I believe."
"From Her Majesty," said Buckingham, growing so pale that D'Artagnan thought he was about to fall.
And he broke the seal.
"What is this rent?" asked he, showing D'Artagnan a place where it was pierced through.
"Ah," said D'Artagnan, "I did not perceive it before. The sword of the Count de Wardes must have done that, when it was boring a hole in my chest."
"Are you wounded?" inquired Buckingham.
"Oh, a mere trifle," said D'Artagnan, "a mere scratch."
"Just heaven, what have I read?" exclaimed Buckingham.
"Patrick, remain here, or rather find the king, wherever he may be, and tell his majesty that I humbly beseech him to excuse me, but that an affair of the very greatest importance calls me to London. Come, sir, come."
And both took their way to the capital at full gallop.
21. The Countess de Winter. As they hurried on, the Duke heard from D'Artagnan not really all that had occurred, but all that D'Artagnan himself knew. By putting together what fell from the lips of the young man, and what was supplied by his own recollections, he was enabled to form a pretty exact idea of that position, of the seriousness of which the Queen's letter, short as it was, afforded abundant proof. But what most astonished him was that the Cardinal, interested as he was that this youth should not set foot in England, had not managed to stop him on his way. It was then, and on the expression of this astonishment, that D'Artagnan related to him the precautions which had been taken, and how, thanks to the devotion of his three friends, whom he had left bleeding here and there upon the road, he had managed to get off with merely the wound which had pierced the Queen's letter, and which he had so terribly repaid to Monsieur de Wardes. Whilst listening to this account, given with the greatest simplicity, the Duke looked from time to time on the young man with astonishment, as if he could not comprehend how so much prudence, courage, and devotion could be combined with a countenance which did not yet show the traces of 20 years. The horses went like the wind, and they were soon at the gates of London. D'Artagnan had supposed that, on entering the town, the Duke would slacken his pace, but he did not. He continued his course at the same rate, caring little for upsetting those who were in his way. In fact, in passing through the city, two or three accidents of this kind happened, but Buckingham did not even turn his head to see what had become of those he had knocked over. D'Artagnan followed him, in the midst of cries which sounded very much like maledictions. On entering the courtyard of his mansion, Buckingham jumped off his horse, and, without caring what became of him, threw the bridle over his neck and rushed towards the staircase. D'Artagnan did the same, with somewhat more uneasiness, nevertheless, for these noble animals whose merit he appreciated. But he had the satisfaction of seeing three or four servants hurrying from the kitchens and stables, and immediately laying hold of the horses. The Duke walked so quickly that D'Artagnan had some difficulty in following him. He passed through many saloons, magnificent to a degree which the most distinguished nobles of France could not even imagine, and came at last to a bedchamber, which was at once a miracle of taste and splendour. In the alcove of this chamber there was a door in the tapestry, which the Duke opened by a small golden key, which he carried suspended at his neck by a chain of the same metal. Through politeness D'Artagnan remained behind, but at the moment that Buckingham stepped over the threshold of this door, he turned, and perceiving the hesitation of the young man, "Come," said he, "and if you have the happiness of being admitted into the presence of the Queen of France,
tell her what you have beheld." Encouraged by this invitation, D'Artagnan followed the duke, who closed the door behind him. They found themselves in a small chapel, splendidly illuminated by a profusion of wax lights,